Julie Candler with the BBC News. The Nigerian army says two officers are to face trial for the bombing of a village last year that's said to have killed more than 100 people. The military has said the victims were mistaken for terrorists. The BBC's Chris Iwoko reports from Abuja.
Reacting to the announcement by the military, Secretary to the village head of Tudumbiri, Magaji Aliu Adamu, told the BBC that the move will be seen as justice served for the people of the community. He said that it was a welcome development that the army could accept responsibility for its mistakes, but noted that the affected families are still waiting to be compensated. In December last year, a drone operated by the Nigerian army bombed residents of Tudumbiri during a religious festival. Amnesty International reported that at least 127 villagers were killed in the incident.
The Congolese army and the rebel M23 group have blamed each other for a deadly bombing at a displacement camp in the eastern city of Goma on Friday. At least 9 people were killed, including 7 children. A government spokesperson claimed the attack was an act of retaliation after the army destroyed a rebel weapons depot. Kinshasa has repeatedly blamed Rwanda in the past for backing the rebels. President William Ruto has warned Kenya that Kenya could experience its first ever cyclone as Hidaya gains momentum along the Tanzanian coast. Mr. Ruto said the cyclone could hit at any time. Here's Temeskin Devesai.
Kenya and Tanzania have been bracing themselves for the arrival of Cyclone Hidaya, following a period of heavy rains and floods that have wrought havoc across East Africa. On Friday, President Ruto said more than 200 people had died in Kenya alone, with livelihoods disrupted and infrastructure damaged in the process. With the situation expected to worsen in the coming days, Mr. Ruto has ordered the evacuation of everyone living in flood-prone areas. Schools that were scheduled to reopen on Monday will also remain closed until further notice.
South Korean authorities say companies will need to notify customers if they reduce the size of their products or face fines of up to more than $7,000. The new measure comes in response to growing public frustration of such practices. Jae Sung Lee reports.
Shrinkflation is when businesses downsize the portions of their products while maintaining the price. From August, South Korea's antitrust regulator says it will designate this an unfair act subject to penalties unless companies tell their consumers of such a change. The new rule stipulates that manufacturers of basic items must clearly label the reduction in quantity on the product's packages, stores, or websites for 3 months. Shrinkflation has become an annoyance for consumers worldwide as households struggle with diminishing purchasing power amid soaring inflation.
World news from the BBC. Egyptian mediators have told a US newspaper that Israel has given Hamas a week to agree to the current proposal for a ceasefire and the release of hostages in Gaza, or it will begin its long-promised offensive in Rafah. A senior Hamas official has said the group is studying the proposal in a positive spirit. The Chinese Space Agency has launched a rocket carrying a probe that will aim for the first time to collect samples from the far side of the moon and return them successfully to Earth. The Chang'e 6 mission blasted off from the Wenchang Space Launch Center in southern Hainan province. The spacecraft will attempt to make a soft landing on the South Pole Aitken Basin. The judge overseeing Donald Trump's hush money trial has corrected the former president's false assertion that a gag order prevented him from testifying on his own behalf. At the beginning of the session, Judge Juan Marchan told Mr. Trump that he had an absolute right to testify at trial. More from Neda Taufik, who's following the case.
It is the reality that Donald Trump is a candidate for presidential office and often uses the doors outside of the courtroom to campaign. And so the judge wanted to set the record straight that when Donald Trump last night, as he was leaving, had told reporters that he wasn't able to testify because of the gag order, the judge wanted him to know that that was not true, that he has an absolute constitutional right to do so, and that the gag order only applies to his statements outside of the courtroom.
San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf is experiencing a record surge in sea lions. The marine mammals have become a popular tourist attraction since first appearing after the 1989 earthquake. Visitors can usually see about 100 of them, but officials say they've counted more than 1,000, all sunbathing, barking and getting fat on a huge school of anchovies that's attracted the increased numbers. The authorities say with sea lions weighing up to half a ton, the barges they lounge on are being tested to their limits. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinur. Today marks the fifth day of the UW-Madison student encampment against Israel genocide in Palestine. 2 days ago, a combined police force, including the Dane County Sheriff Department and State Patrol, brutally attacked the peaceful protesters, injuring three professors of color and arresting them, together with 27 additional people. Yesterday, faculty and staff met with Chancellor Mnookin, who promised there would be no more police raids before the next meeting, which was today at 8:30 a.m. And we will talk about what we know about that meeting. Also today, high school students are leaving their schools and marching to the Capitol to support an end to Israel's attack. Some of the people who were arrested are charged with felonies and will have a hearing at 1:30 today. To discuss all that and the movement as a whole of students creating encampments throughout the country to try and force their universities and colleges to at least divest in money that supports Israel. We have three young women with us today. Dalia Saba is a first-year graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a member of the UW-Madison chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. Her father is Palestinian and was born in Gaza. She had family members in Gaza until this past week when they were fortunately able to evacuate to Egypt. Also with us is Lily Zindorf-Schell. She is a PhD student at UW-Madison who has been teaching undergraduate students there as a TA and lecturer for 6 years. She grew up in New York City and is the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. And also with us is Abby Klein, first-year PhD student at UW-Madison and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine and other community and university organizations which are part of the encampment where she has been since it was set up. She's an anti-Zionist Jew raised in a Zionist family, and I want to thank all three of you for joining us today. And I want to say that we must remember that however bad things got here in Madison and even worse in other encampments throughout the country, we must remember that none of it gets near the horrors in Gaza and the West Bank. And I think it's very important to remember that this movement is in support of a ceasefire, among other things, in Gaza, and that is the most important thing. I would like to start by asking each of you about your personal history. You all said something about the background that you come from and how that eventually brought you to the encampment. Dalia, let's start with you.
Yeah, so as Esti mentioned in my introduction, my father is Palestinian, his family is Palestinian. So my grandparents were born in Jerusalem and in Haifa, respectively. They were violently forced out of their homes in 1948 during the Nakba. My grandfather recounts, he recounted being met with gunfire following his car as he fled with his family to Gaza. So my grandparents met in Gaza. They had their four kids there. And then they left Gaza in 1967 during that war. But my father's cousins were in Gaza until very recently. They were trapped in the north of Gaza for months, sheltering in a church. Many of them had their homes destroyed. And, you know, thank God they were able to evacuate recently. But unfortunately, there are many people still in Gaza facing those experiences and facing that horror. So I'm out here at the encampment because of the horrors I've, you know, heard about from my family, but also witnessed from other people's families and loved ones and other people in Gaza online, as well as, you know, knowing the broader history of the colonization of Palestine and the way that American institutions are so complicit in it.
Mm-hmm. May I ask quickly, do you know what it took for your family to get out of Gaza?
I don't know the details because also communication has been difficult. I know that they had to coordinate with someone who could theoretically arrange transportation because it is so difficult and dangerous to travel in Gaza right now, especially going from the north to the south. I know it also, for one of my dad's cousins, there was an extra delay because of trying to figure out how to get a permit from the Egyptian government to go through the Rafah border crossing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, Abby, what's your story?
Yeah, so I was raised in a prominently Reformed Jewish community. I didn't really realize what Zionism was for most of my life. It was just kind of an undercurrent that was always there. It wasn't until I was in college and actually went on Birthright that I started to question things I'd been told growing up, like that Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land. And I guess I went on Birthright in 2018, and it was around the time that other students on a Birthright trip left their trip to go to the West Bank. And that was kind of the big controversy at the time. And that kind of pulled me into, well, why would they do that? And trying to learn more when I was in Israel. And I wasn't really getting satisfactory answers. In fact, I was getting answers that made me feel like I was being sold a story, that made me feel like I was being indoctrinated in a way. So when I came back from Birthright, I started doing a lot of my own research, started really reconciling the cognitive dissonance of having grown up in a Zionist family, learning what that means, learning the history of the Palestinian people and of the Nakba, and really trying to better myself. I'm out here as there is a lot of discourse about these encampments being anti-Semitic, standing firmly in my belief that they are in no way, shape, or form anti-Semitic. And it's, in fact, like, framing it in that way is obfuscating from the real issue at hand, which is that tens and thousands of people are being needlessly slaughtered and our university is complicit in it. So I think it's important to be out there as part of the Jewish community and just as a human, because at the end of the day, we're fighting for human rights.
Yeah, thank you. Lily.
Hi, yeah, thanks so much. So my perspective is coming from growing up very culturally Jewish, and specifically not just with a kind of family culture and growing up in New York City, just like a kind of larger culture heavily influenced by Judaism, but that my grandparents and everyone in that generation of my mom's side of the family are all Holocaust survivors. They were in concentration camps as children throughout Eastern Europe, and I would say most of their family, most of my extended family was murdered in concentration camps, some of them as children. And then they were able to, after being liberated from the camps, to reconvene in Germany, and then came to the US in a couple of waves in the 50s. And I would say that growing up as a Holocaust survivor descendant is a huge part of my family identity and of my identity as well as their grandchild. And I think what draws me to the Palestinian struggle is specifically the values that I've gained from growing up with their experiences in the Holocaust as part of my identity. The idea of, you know, finding home in community and not in land, of experiencing this forced displacement, not being able to return, the importance of freedom of movement, and the resulting just kind of absolute objection to state violence. And I think the way that this intersected for me with becoming an anti-Zionist and becoming very cognizant of the Palestinian struggle. I never went on Birthright, but I had a lot of friends who did. And growing up in a not particularly religious, but very culturally Jewish environment, Birthright was often really looked at as like just a free trip to Israel, like a free vacation almost, by a lot of people I know who went. And the experience of, and hearing their experiences, and specifically of being greeted at the airport with big banners that said welcome home, to a place that they had never been and had no family in and no connection to, while learning about, you know, the experiences that Palestinians were having at checkpoints, trying to even just return to their homes, like after working across the border at the end of the day, that cognitive dissonance really, I think, opened my mind. And I've been interested and involved in the Palestinian struggle ever since then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Abby, what are the demands of the encampment?
Yeah, we have a list of demands. Did you want me to walk through each of them?
Yeah, let's just note them for now and we can talk about them.
Sure. So we are asking that the university disclose where our money is being put, divest from financial institutions such as like BlackRock that are complicit in facilitating this genocide through like weapons manufacturing. We are asking that cops be removed from campus. We are asking them to call for an immediate ceasefire. We are asking for the university to stop land grabs. And lastly, to cut ties with Israeli institutions.
And Dalia, you were not involved, you were not at the meeting today with Chancellor Mnuchin, but you can tell us about some things that happened there. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, you know, we've made it very clear to the chancellor and to the university administration that we plan to stay out in the encampment until our demands are met. Because as we've seen, this is not just a few people. This is an encampment and a list of demands that has gotten broad support from students, from staff, faculty, community members. And so, yeah, in the meeting today, some student representatives went in and the chancellor basically just talked about how powerless she was and refused to do anything other than set up a call with the UW Foundation. However, the point of us lobbying the university is because she does have significant leverage over the foundation. And so our ask of her, and you know what we really need her to show, is that she is willing to use her leverage to pressure the UW Foundation to both disclose what it's actually invested in, because most of that is private, and to then divest from these companies that are profiting off of the occupation, off of the genocide.
Mm-hmm. That is so interesting to hear. Do you believe? I mean, it sounds like you don't really believe that she's powerless, but. Yeah, what? How do you feel about that line of reasoning? And also, what does that mean by way of, is she going to send the police again? Or what? Yeah, talk about these.
Yeah. So I guess I'll answer your second point first. The police action was not discussed in the meeting this morning, so We don't know She has not committed, as she did yesterday, to no further police action. All she said regarding that is reiterating that the university wants the tents to come down, which, of course, the tents have been the form of leverage that we are using to bring these demands to the table. But in terms of like the university's power in all of this, I think it's important to recognize that UW-Madison, you know, it's a public university, but it is specifically structured and its investments are specifically structured in such a way to make them completely unaccountable to students and to taxpayers, because the UW Foundation is a private institution which hides all of its investments. And so the point in us bringing these demands to the university is to say, sure, you have this system that is set up so that you can say, well, I don't have control over it. It's a private institution. And that's exactly the problem here. And that's what we're trying to rectify, is how can we make these institutions accountable to us, because it's our money that's funding them.
Yeah. And just going back briefly to the issue of police, I thought she just agreed that there would be no police action until this morning when the meeting occurred. Do we have any, is there any development in that sense? Has she made any new promises?
Again, I was not in that meeting, but after talking with students who was, she has not, to my knowledge, renewed any such promise. So we hope that, you know, if, since she's claiming to negotiate in good faith, that seems to imply that negotiating in good faith would not include sending police to attack the people you're negotiating with. But based on the incidents of Wednesday morning, there are no guarantees.
Lily, so Dahlia just talked about the foundation and its role. I also am wondering about very wealthy donors and their role behind the scenes in pressuring the university. And as people who are involved in the university, how do you feel about it? What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because as graduate students, especially in this movement, we're in a very specific position where we are students of the university, but we also have students of our own who we feel responsible towards, it's this kind of strange position to be in terms of what our like responsibilities are, and in terms of where we can like draw our power from. I think in terms of donors, kind of specific donors, that's not something that I have tons of capability to speak on. So I would be interested to hear from the other folks if they do. But I think it's very, yeah, it's a interesting position to be in, and then learning more about everything that's happening behind the scenes, the kind of like so many institutions as well as individuals, then with the power of other institutions behind them, even who have the ability to influence the university, which claims to exist for its students, for the research that it's doing, and then not serving students, graduate students who are educators as well, right, in addition to students, and then faculty, is a very interesting position to be in.
Mm-hmm. Does either of you have knowledge or thoughts about private donors and their role?
I can't speak to specifics, but I do know that the chancellor has alluded to being under pressure from presumably donors.
Yeah.
And again, I think it all comes back to the fact that like this is a higher learning institution and it's also a public institution. It should be accountable to its students and to the broader community in Wisconsin and in Madison. It should not be accountable, you know, it should not have its policies dictated by a few wealthy donors.
Yeah, and also as an institution of higher learning, one would think that independent thinking, being able to critique and criticize trends in the United States government or anywhere else, not to mention freedom of speech would be sacred, and that the thought of sending police against it would be unacceptable. Abby?
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a very important point. The first thing is, I think that the sending of the police to brutalize students the other day, which is what happened, really just emphasizes the fact that this university cares about property over people. They were willing to physically injure their own students, their workers, their researchers that ultimately make this university money, that make it the foremost institution that it is. They were willing to arrest them, to brutalize them for the sake of tents. And I think that that's also, in terms of valuing freedom of speech, is a kind of willful ignorance on the university that they're choosing to structure this argument about, saying that they just want the tents down. And as we've discussed, that's our leverage. We know that's not true. They keep saying things like, you know, we respect your right for free speech. Just take the tents down. You can protest. That hasn't worked. We've tried. And this is where we are now. And it's very clear that their priority is not our well-being. It's protecting their monetary interests.
Yeah. I want to read a comment from our engineer, Summer, who writes, this also intersects with increasing university privatization and defunding across the country, but particularly in Wisconsin. And of course, in some way, what Mnookin says is correct, isn't it? I mean, as the government gives less and less money to education, period, and to higher education specifically, there's much more dependence on money from people with interests. Lily?
Yeah, I wanted to say, too, that I think we're seeing this at universities across the country who are responding to encampments on their campuses, but especially here at UW-Madison, that universities are seeking to capitalize on whatever, you know, histories of student protest or student activism that they have when it serves them, and to, you know, speak of student protests of the past or a tradition of student protest with pride as something that defines the university in a positive light. And I think that now we see how they actually respond to it. And even in this moment, they are still straddling that line. Whereas in yesterday, after the police left, Chancellor Mnookin sent out an email, a campus-wide email, seeking to address what had happened. And something that she said in that email was that civil disobedience has been a time-honored tradition in our nation, including here. Yet it is a long-standing element of the civil disobedience tradition to respect the laws we share. And I think that the cognitive dissonance in there, I think, was striking to a lot of us who were reading this email out loud at the encampment yesterday. The idea that civil disobedience has to be obedient doesn't make a ton of sense to us.
Yeah. Well, let me reintroduce you all. You just heard from Lily Zindorf-Schell. We also have with us in the studio Abby Klein and Dahlia Saba. They're all graduate students and all involved in the encampment that has been going on for 5 days now. Am I correct? 5 days, correct? Yeah. At Library Mall, and where... if you go, you will find that the atmosphere there is absolutely lovely. You know, I've spent a lot of time there, but I think the second night that I spent there, I did not stay for the night, but the time that I spent there, I actually was jealous of you all. It reminded me of when I was your age, and you know, circles of people talking, singing, the beautiful people's kitchen that you have, the programs that you are involved in every day, which reminds me, Abby, are you involved in the Shabbat tonight?
Yes,
I am. You want to tell people about that?
Yeah, tonight, in the encampment, a Shabbat is being put on for the community, for the encampment, and is being led by a group of anti-Zionist Jews. So we're really excited about that.
And I think that's very important, and we'll get to that in a second, because of the whole conceit, I would say, of anti-Semitic, anti-Semitic attitudes, which I have not seen at all. But let me first invite our listeners to call if they have relevant questions or comments, 608-256-2001. You can also join us on social media at Wart Talk on X or A Public Affair on Facebook. So we're hearing an awful lot about anti-Semitism. Let me ask you first, Dahlia, are you an anti-Semite?
I guess I can say off the bat, no. But I think really what this boils down to and what we've seen in many forms, that I think the anti-Semitism smears are like probably the most common way of doing this, but the mainstream press narrative will use anything they can to avoid talking about Palestine. They do everything they can to avoid talking about the history of colonization, to talk about the ongoing genocide, to talk about the realities of the occupation and the apartheid legal system that Palestinians face to this day. And so I think when we, you know, I think it's important to, obviously we have many people on this call who can attest to the presence of Jewish community members and involvement of people of all faiths and backgrounds in this encampment, because again, we're here fighting for human rights. That's not something that's specific to any one faith or any one background. But I think that when we talk about anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism is a problem in its own right that it is important to address. But to bring it up only in response to Palestine and to divert attention from the horrific genocide that's going on right now, to, you know, making sure that everybody does all of their full denials of anti-Semitism, really just serves to take attention away from the fact that our institutions here in the United States, including both our government and UW-Madison, are complicit in an ongoing genocide.
Yeah, yeah. And yet you made an important point there that I'm thinking of Charlottesville, for example, right? And Trump, trumping that there are nice people and so on and so forth. I did not hear any denouncement of anti-Semitism at the time, including from, for example, House Speaker Johnson, who is now very concerned about anti-Semitism in the various encampments. But I don't remember hearing anything from him or from any of these other people who are now crowing, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just looking at UW-Madison, we had neo-Nazis march through Madison just a few months ago.
Yeah,
And the police didn't do anything to them. But you see them violently attacking students who are calling to, you know, stop the university's complicity in violence.
Can I just jump in there really quick? Yes. I also think something that's really interesting about that discourse that is going on nationwide about anti-Semitism and about Jewish students feeling safe on campus given these encampments is that what's never been centered is Palestinians feeling safe on campus and Muslim students feeling safe on campus. And they've been facing Islamophobia on campus for years, for their whole lives. I'm not Palestinian, and perhaps Dahlia is better to speak to this, but I've heard so many people in our encampment say this encampment is the first time they feel like they are safe, except for when the police are there, of course.
Yeah.
And obviously it is important for everyone to feel safe on campus, but it's important to note that, again, anti-Semitism is a distinct issue in and of itself, that placing it in the context of wanting a genocide to end is obfuscating the real issue. And it's really interesting to consider why we are so focused on the feelings of Jewish students in particular, but no one else's feelings.
Some Jewish students.
Thank you.
And also, I know, Lily, you wanna chime in, and I'll let you in a second, but I've been asked about that, and I must say, I saw one Jewish student who jumped into the encampment with very inflammatory signs and was asked by the police to move away. And immediately all the media just landed on him. They all wanted to hear what he said. And I talked with him a little bit, and he was certainly not intimidated. He was the opposite. He was involved. What he was doing was a provocation. And but they all wanted to hear from him. I also have seen groups of Jewish students wrapped in Israel flags and just sitting there quietly doing their thing. I have never seen anyone harassing them. They certainly didn't look scared to me. I mean, I don't know what they feel inside, but they are the ones that the media are concentrating on. Lily.
Yeah, thank you. I think your kind of comment at the beginning there, Esty, about like some Jewish students is kind of what I wanted to speak on. That the thing that I think myself and a number of Jewish students involved in the encampment who I've talked to really struggle with is this conflation by Zionist students, by the media kind of at large, and by Chancellor Mnuchin of Zionist students and Jewish students. And I think it's extremely important to be clear that not only do the Zionist students and folks who are making those opinions known at the encampments not speak for Jewish students, but that Israel is not Judaism, right? And that Israel and what we are talking about is a state, and that the religious and the cultural aspects of Judaism, although they're obviously inextricably connected, are different things from each other. And so, you know, I think you see that too in Chancellor Mnuchin's email from yesterday. She said something about, you know, Jewish students have felt anxious and unsafe all week. And I'm looking at that and thinking, well, I didn't feel anxious or unsafe until I was up against a riot shield yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there, and I've heard this over and over again, just the phrasing of Jewish students as if Jewish students are a monolith that are opposed to what we are doing here. And that's been like really honestly emotionally difficult to deal with, you know, just like anecdotally. I think in the time leading up to the encampment, I have a little like Star of David necklace that I wear almost every day. And I took it off because I didn't want that to be misconstrued as support for something that I condemn. Mm-hmm. And it's just difficult to hear Judaism being pitted, not just that the movement is anti-Semitic or that there aren't Jews in the movement, but that Judaism and Jewish students are somehow antithetical or just opposed by virtue of being Jewish to what we are doing here.
Yeah. And if I could jump in for a second, kind of to Abby's earlier point, you know, the chancellor and the media are talking about, you know, so much focused on the safety threats to safety of Jewish students, which, you know, to my knowledge, you know, everybody should feel safe. But to my knowledge, I don't know of any specific incidents. But I do know of several incidents that have happened this week where students wearing hijab or students wearing a kufiya mm-hmm. were approached and harassed and in some cases faced, you know, violence from people walking around the encampment. So I think that, again, to Abby's earlier point, the focus solely on the safety of Jewish students, you know, again, it's another way of distracting from the broader violence that Palestinians are facing in Palestine, but also the intense hatred of Palestinians that this country has and that our institutions have.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller. Let's get to Douglas. Hi, Douglas. You're on the air.
Hello. At the risk of angering folks, I have heard from both my son, who's 24, not in college. He's a working kid. And my father, who's 89, a Korean War veteran, say that the protesters are nothing more than entitled kids with nothing else to do. I'm just curious what your guests have to say about that perspective. Thank you.
Thanks. Abby?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective to take, considering that the three of us on this call right now are graduate students, meaning we are grad student workers, meaning all of us have responsibilities in terms of we have a literal contract that we are paid to do. We're paid to do our research. We're paid to teach, be teaching assistants, research assistants. And we are also paid, or not paid, but we take classes to do research to make money for this university. Mm. This university runs because we work. This university makes money because we work. And at the end of the day, we are three busy graduate students, and we are taking our time to be here. We are doing work at the encampment, doing our final papers, studying, but we're also fighting for basic human rights. And I think if you want to say somebody can be doing this with having nothing better to do, even if that were the case, which it's not, fighting for basic human rights is something everyone should be behind at any time. Wanting to get the university to disclose and divest so that our money isn't going to needlessly slaughtering tens of thousands of people. It shouldn't matter what you do outside of not wanting that to happen. You should just not want that to happen.
Yeah, and on top of all of that, you also are at risk of being attacked by police brutally. So, yeah, Dahlia. Yeah.
I also think that the narrative that of entitlement is incredibly disrespectful to the numerous Palestinian students involved in this who have faced a traumatic past 6 months, seeing family members starved, have their homes destroyed, and even killed by this country that our taxpayer dollars are being sent to. So I think that talking about entitlement during a genocide feels extremely tone deaf to me. And I welcome people from all backgrounds, you know, even if you grew up in a literal ivory tower, I think that everybody should be able to say there are more important things going on in the world. And a genocide is not something that you fight just because you have nothing better to do. A genocide is something that you fight because it is our moral imperative to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. And Douglas, I hope you share this show or at least this segment with your father and son. Surely everyone can be educated and changed. Lily, anything you wanted to add to that, or shall we go on to the next caller?
Just very briefly, I want to say too that out of, you know, not only are we putting ourselves at risk, the three of us, you know, individually on this call or the folks at the encampment as a whole, but we saw in the police violence that happened on Wednesday that the professors, as you mentioned, who were arrested and particularly brutalized were professors of color. I saw numerous students of color, both Palestinian and Arab, and also Black American students who were being brutalized by police and arrested. And so the risk levels that people are taking to be there are extremely high. And that, you know, that doesn't compute for me with the idea of a sense of entitlement. If you look at the way that police violence happens in this country, not just in terms of these encampments, but in terms of police violence against people of color, more broadly speaking.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, several of these people who were arrested are facing felony charges, which, if that sticks, will affect them for the rest of their lives. So that seems to me like a sacrifice that's quite significant. But let's go to our next caller. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about the tents. I'm sorry to change the subject because I think what you've been talking about is really good right now. But I wanted to say something about the tents. First thing is if you remove the tents, that would just mostly allow the administration to ignore you. That's one thing. But the other thing is the symbolism of the tent. I mean, you're camped out in tents, and that means that you guys are in housing that is probably better than 90% of Gazans at this point. And I think it's kind of a demonstration of where, you know, a little, you know, a minor demo. How do I say it? It's, you know, it's better housing than most Gazans have.
Yeah.
And it's like, and if the police come in and attack you, that's kind of a demonstration of what the Israelis have done. It's, you know, it's a symbolic demonstration, but still, it's, you know, that's kind of what the Israeli attack on Gaza has been. It's like, let's just take everything away from them, you know?
Yes, thank you, Dan. Good point. I think he made his point. Anything you girls want to add?
I think that's exactly spot on. I just want to add to the point that, like, what the people of in Rafah specifically, who are camped out in tents after being forced out of their homes, they do not have access to bathrooms. They do not have access to showers. Us in the encampment, you know, we have community members donating food. We can head into the library to use the bathroom and brush our teeth. We can, you know, head home briefly to take a shower. These are, you know, basic needs that the majority of people in Gaza do not have access to at this time.
Yeah, and if there were a pregnant woman among you and she had to give birth, she would be taken to the hospital, and there's no more hospitals in Gaza, and there's a good chance that that woman's child would not die, even if the labor was hard and so on. Abby?
Yeah, I think this circles back to what I was mentioning earlier about sort of a willful ignorance or neglect by the university or focusing on property over people. They are just seeing the tents as a problem. Like the caller said, the tents are our leverage and the tents are symbolic, and they care more about tents than the well-being of their students. And they've made that very perfectly clear in allowing the police to enact violence on us.
Yeah, and people have been digging photos of tents on various parts of campus that have not been attacked by police, that have totally been sanctioned. Lily?
Yeah, and nothing really to add there. I think our caller and Abby and Dahlia said it all.
Yeah, so we have a third caller. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Esty. Dahlia, Lily, and Abby, I'm proud of you all, and particularly coming from disparate backgrounds. My concern, and this is from my own experience 50 years ago on Library Mall during the Vietnam era, is that the protests will be dissipated to zilch upon the completion of the semester proper. Are there any plans, any tactical plans to keep the encampment going in the face of the end of the semester? Thank you.
Abby.
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you for kind of like leading the way for us. We've took a lot of inspiration from what your student movement did, and we hope to be as effective as you all were. In terms of as the semester comes to an end, we're not planning on going anywhere. We are staying here indefinitely until our demands are met. While that might get difficult as undergrads leave for the summer, PhD students, most of us stay here for the summer. We're not going anywhere. The encampment isn't just students. We are a broad coalition of people from faculty to staff to community members who are going to stay steadfast and strong.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to add that we are not forgetting what's going on. This is, you know, the fight for Palestinian liberation has gone on for decades now. And this genocide has gone on for months. And we are still out here more steadfast than ever in fighting for our university to end its complicity. And so, you know, the summer can come. If the university wants to wait us out through the summer can go. But this is about making sure that our university is no longer complicit in genocide, apartheid, and colonization. And this is something that goes beyond a couple weeks out on the lawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I heard a Palestinian yesterday. His name is Sami Awad. He's in the West Bank, and he was telling a story of taking some journalists to see what's going on there, and they saw a woman outdoors making pita, and one of the journalists said to her, so, you know, when will you have liberation, or something like that. I can't remember the exact question. But she said, she just kept making the pita and said, you know, the Turks were here and they left. The British were here and they left. Now the Zionists are here and they will also leave. So, yeah, there's a long view of what's going on. We have another question from someone who did not want to ask it on the air, but let me ask you. He or she says, I've heard that George Soros is financing these protests by paying organizers. Have you seen any evidence of that? Are you getting checks in your bank from George Soros?
That would be really, really nice.
I think it is funny that they're doing anti-Semitism on the pro-Palestine protests. Yeah. By implying that...
Explain what you mean.
You know, I think the people have been making various claims about George Soros for years now, rooted in the, you know, trope that Jewish rich people are funding everything in the world.
Jewish bankers.
Yeah. And I think it's really funny when people point to the fact that many of the tents are the same type to try to imply some conspiracy. Rather, if you look up the price of the tents, we are simply, you know, we're a community funded movement. We take everything from like Venmo and Cash App from local community members, and we are getting the cheapest possible tents we can find at Walmart or wherever.
Yeah, and I know that people from the community are bringing food every day, and today you're getting a big food donation from a Palestinian restaurant in Milwaukee.
We are.
You didn't know that?
Yeah.
That's so exciting.
and people have donated tents and sleeping bags and so on and so forth because people support what you're doing. So we have very little time left. I want to look at the bigger picture of the movement. This is happening all over. We're not going to have much time to discuss it, but we know what happened in UCLA, where a group of pro-Israel vigilantes attacked the protesters in the middle of the night. We know what happened in Colombia, which was very peaceful until the chancellor there called the police on the protesters, and they brutalized them, I think, even worse than what happened here. And that, of course, caused an escalation, which caused yet another escalation through the police. And, you know, I read the statement by Jay Rothman, the head of the whole UW system, doing a really master piece of double speak. I heard Biden too doing the same thing. Let me quote him exactly. In America, we respect the right and protect the right for them to express that. The right of to speech, to free speech, I imagine. But it doesn't mean anything goes. It needs to be done without violence, without destruction, without hate, and within the law. So let me ask each of you what your thoughts are about the fact that it has become a real big movement, that now here the high school students are supporting. And I'm sure that happens elsewhere. Let's start with you, Lily.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's the most important thing to me, I think, is to ultimately foreground our demands and what we are fighting for and what we are camped out for, as people are saying. And as Abby said, the idea that we're not going anywhere until these demands are met. And I think some words that have been very meaningful to me, two points that come from a Palestinian journalist, Bisan, who has gained a really large Instagram following during this. She makes videos talking about her experience in Gaza. And two things that she has said in the last couple of days that I think I've found to be very grounding. The first one was that she said in her 24 years in Gaza, she has never felt hope like this because of what is happening here. And the fact that people in Gaza see what is happening here across the country and that it is having an effect on them and their well-being. And the second thing she said is what I said earlier, which is to not lose sight of what is going on, to keep all eyes on Gaza, and to keep keep in mind what we are doing this for, and not let the media's fascination — this is my own kind of interpretation of that — but to not let the media's like fascination with anti-Semitism, fascination with like weird, you know, generational divides, or like what, you know, college kids are doing these days or whatever, to distract from what is going on in Palestine and why we are doing this.
Yeah, thank you, Abby.
Yeah, I think something that I want to center in light of all the discourse about the encampments, and I guess kind of also echoing what the chancellor said in terms of civil disobedience and lawlessness, and as we were hearing you just quote Biden, the encampment is one of the most beautiful communities I've ever been a part of. It is a place where we keep us safe, where we protect each other, where everybody is caring about one another and standing for basic human rights. It's our moral imperative to do so. And we're all out there taking care of each other. We're out there standing on university property in solidarity with the people of Gaza, with the students of Gaza who no longer have any universities because they've all been bombed.
Right.
And we built a library. We had a people's kitchen. We have teach-ins. We have art projects. And it's a beautiful place. So I think the depiction of it as like lawless civil disobedience and being problematic on a campus is a gross mischaracterization, which is actually happening. And yeah, this is the most...
Yeah.
It's a lovely community that I'm so happy I'm a part of.
Dahlia, we have only about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I think that these, you know, we've seen, of course, violent repression, all of these threats from universities. But I think that what we are really out here and what we're inspired by is the steadfastness of the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine, who have been facing horrors worse than we could even imagine, and have continued fighting and continued staying strong, and demanding justice. And so I think that is what keeps us going through all of this, you know, police inflicted violence. And I think the other thing is that the way that these universities are responding so hysterically shows that our actions are actually a threat to the power of these institutions. And that only reinvigorates us to continue fighting to dismantle these institutions that support the occupation and the injustice and the colonization in Palestine.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's it's hard to say, because I think that the genocide is really changing the way people see things, and then what you all do all over the country really is very much supportive of it. Moshe, I'm sorry, we don't have time anymore. Next time, please call earlier. I'm sure we'll continue talking about these things. Abby Klein, Lily Zindorf-Schell, and Dahlia Saba, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for your work. Thank you for what you're doing. And I will see you tonight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank
oh,
you.
I'll see you at Shabbat.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Tell people again. Amazing. Quickly, very quickly.
Oh, tonight, 7:30, I believe, there will be a Shabbat dinner at the encampment in Library Mall. Please come join us for a lovely service, a lovely anti-Zionist service.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, as usual, to Jade, Summer, and Rick. I'm Esti Dinor. We'll be talking again next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to WORT Madison. Stay tuned for Mel and Floyd.
Wow! I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you. Sugar and spice.
feel nice, like sugar and spice.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. Floyd is on assignment, but with us, as always, the man who knows everything, Mr. Smart and Pants.
I am he.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. Good. I walked over today. It's a gorgeous
it's
day.
It's a beautiful day out there.
I was just appreciating the reality of existence.
Yeah.
And, sometimes that's hard to appreciate. Sometimes you want to live in that dream world, you know, because things aren't all peachy keen.
Yeah.
But every now and then you find that little piece.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you say, that's pretty damn good.
That's nice. We're exactly the right distance from the sun. We've got just the right amount of electromagnetic protection.
Yeah.
Ultraviolet protection.
I was walking by Brittingham Park, and some of those older houses there, their backyards they're kind of frowsy. I like frowsy, by the way. You know me. I'm a big frowsy fan.
Yeah, you are.
And so
Mr. Frowsy.
Mr. Frowsy. Yeah. I look in the backyards, and there's just carpet of little wildflowers, just eating up the ground there, and I'm just all over the place. I'm just like, wow, that is so great. And the thing about this nice is nobody's doing that. It's just doing it on its own.
You don't dump pesticides and fertilizer on there.
These flowers are having a great old time. You know?
And the bees like it.
Yeah,
too,
the bees, the deadly bees.
The killer bees. Yeah. What happened to the killer bees?
I don't know. I think they reformed. they're tired of the killing. I wish humans could be that way.
That does happen to humans.
That would be nice.
I mean, you know, they sort of age out of crime.
Do they?
Most people.
I don't know. I think they just tell the younger ones to do it for them.
Well, maybe, yeah.
I mean, I'm not talking. I'm not.